Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi, friends. Welcome back to another episode of the New Evangelicals Podcast. On this episode, I have Dr. Matthew Bode, who is a professor at University of North Georgia. He also has a blog slash news site where he critiques Charlie Kirk, which I found very fitting for this week because yesterday was the 4th of July, and there's always this talk of patriotism and Christianity and Christian nationalism. So I wanted to release this episode this week because it kind of plays off of what I talked about on my account on Sunday, and just some of my thoughts in general. But, you know, Dr. Bode really knows his stuff. He specializes in rhetoric teaching, so teaching people what rhetoric is and how to use it. And we talk a lot about Charlie Kirk, his journey from really not talking about his faith in the public spotlight at all, to all of a sudden within the past like year or two, really making that a core part of his message and why that matters. We talk about Christian nationalism, what it actually means, and we also talk about talk radio and what style of rhetoric they employ. I really enjoyed this conversation. It helps me to understand better the foundational principles that are going into this Christian nationalist movement that we're seeing, the conservative talk radio movement that's kind of embed with Christian nationalism, and how the evangelical church plays a part in that, and how all three of those things are tied together. So I really hope that you enjoyed this episode, especially in light of it being a 4th of July weekend. So thanks a lot for checking this one out. That being said, I also want to say thank you so much to all of our supporters. Thank you to everyone who gave us a review recently. We shot up almost like 45 reviews. If you can keep that momentum going, that would be so great. If you have not given us a rating or review on iTunes yet, if you can please do that, it helps us out so much. I can't even tell you how much it helps us out because it lets Apple know to recommend our podcast when people search for general topics that relate to us. Also, if you're watching on YouTube, two quick things. Number one, if you can give us a subscribe and a like, that would be great. And number two, I apologize now for the video quality of this interview. So I recently found a way to actually use my camera, my iPhone as a webcam for my computer through an app called Camo. And this is not a paid promotion. I just love the app so much because instead of having to pay hundreds of dollars for, you know, a real nice camera that has nice features and has the clarity, I can use my iPhone for a really cheap price. So the next couple episodes should be getting better and better as far as video quality, but this one was really bad. Dr. Bode was in like a very low lit room, so it's hard to see him, which it's no big deal. I just want to give you all a heads up. Don't be shocked when it transitions. That being said, friends, I hope you enjoy this episode. One last thing, if you want to support the show and the New Evangelicals, you can donate in the link below. A sincere thank you to everyone who has donated. It seriously helps us out so much. It covers costs. It covers my time. It helps me keep doing this, helps me be able to make time for interviews and to get this content out. So, all right, friends, without further ado, I hope you enjoy this episode.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
On, you know, it's kind of funny because I saw an article you wrote on Twitter. I'm like, I love this dude. I'm going to see if he'll come on the show. And here we are like 3 days later. So I appreciate you making the time. Thanks for coming on to the podcast.
I'm happy to be here.
Okay. Well, let's kick right off into this because for all of the listeners out there, they know I am very passionate about calling out the conservative media machine for kind of hijacking Jesus. You know, and that includes Charlie Kirk, Candace Owens, Sean Hannity, all those guys, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I grew up on a pretty steady diet of Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity my entire life. I was homeschooled and he was on the radio all the time in our household. So I'm very familiar with like that world, but I'm kind of curious to know, like, how did you get involved with like responding to Charlie Kirk's stuff, having a whole website really devoted to responding to him? What gave you the itch to scratch?
I became a professor in 2015 here in Georgia, and I got involved in the statewide campaign to stop concealed carry on campus, guns on campus, campus carry sometimes it's called.
Is that a thing?
Yeah. Oh yes. I'm sorry. You're unaware of that. Yes.
I live by Philadelphia. All right. I live in New Jersey. Right. And so the idea of carrying a weapon on a college campus is just mind blowing to me. So that's a thing.
Yes. There are currently, I think 10, maybe 12 states that allow that. And there are more on the way. They have gone through, it started out as a legal fight. Some NRA types suing university systems to allow it. And then it went through the state legislators. That's how Georgia got it. It had actually been a bill in the Georgia legislature for many years until it finally was passed in 2017.
Recently.
Anyway, so I wrote an editorial for the local paper, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, telling people why that was bad. Several months later, Turning Point USA, which Charlie Kirk runs, did really their first kind of, I think, viral experience, if you will, and started the professor watch list. And there were 100 people named on that the first round, and I was one of the first 100 named. And so I didn't know who he was, nor Turning Point was before that, but I learned quickly who that was there.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, that got me interested in him. And I don't think initially I started writing about him, but I started reading about him and reading about what he wrote. And then, you know, starting your own blog is kind of like, you know, who's going to read this? No one's going to care. And did for a while, but I kept sending it out to people and responding to people on Twitter and responding to Charlie Kirk on Twitter. Eventually he blocked me and all his accounts blocked me, but
nice. Free speech, baby.
Yes. So I write a fact check analysis website about Charlie Kirk, and he targeted me first. So that's what I say to everybody.
Well, it sounds like what I'm hearing you say is that Charlie Kirk sent a mob of people after you. You know, I mean, that's
he didn't send it after me, but certainly many people on that watch list have been targeted in different ways. I'm a professor at a very small school in the middle of nowhere, Georgia, so no one's going to target me. People on that list have been, and so I got involved also because of that with the American Association of University Professors, which is sort of the union for professors in states that allow unions, but in Georgia we call it an advocacy group because we don't have unions. But they have been big in fighting that professor watch list and volunteering to be on the list and things like that. So that's how I got interested in Charlie Kirk.
Yeah, well, you know, it's very interesting because I grew up in a conservative household, homeschooled the whole nine, you know, and I've known about Charlie Kirk for quite a while now, but he, in my mind, he is maybe the biggest conservative media person that you probably don't know about, you know, meaning like a lot of people don't know about him, but he is humongous. Turning Point USA is ginormous. Yeah. They have an army of people on Instagram. And I've noticed this trend where he has like young, beautiful college girls who are like Turning Point ambassadors. And like they just espouse these, like, it's just talking points. There's no substance. It's just talking points. And so, you know, in that sense, he's kind of a genius for how he did everything because he's exploded. But I also find him incredibly problematic for many reasons. I mean, for many. Yes. But the article that I want to bring attention to that you really, I think it was so helpful for me because I didn't even realize this, is that Charlie Kirk didn't start out as like someone who's advocating for taking America back for God. He was way more libertarian, you know, in the beginning. Can you kind of, you know, walk us through this shift of Charlie going from libertarian to like a MAGA loving, you know, take back the country kind of person?
Yeah. For those that don't know, Charlie Kirk started Turning Point USA in 2012 as a high school senior. He got the eyes of a benefactor, Bill Montgomery, who sadly died in 2019. And he, Bill and Charlie, you know, toured a bunch of GOP town halls and tea party groups, which was big in 2012, trying to, you know, start this group. And, you know, he had a happenstance lucky encounter with Foster Fries, who also recently died at the 2012 GOP convention. That was his first big donor. And yes, his message, his mantra, his three phrase way of selling Turning Point USA was a young conservative free market freedom, limited government. That's the three words they use. I mean, his big phrase is big government sucks. And that was the mantra of Turning Point USA. He did a Breitbart article attacking a economics textbook that was being used in some classes, and that got him on Fox News to talk about it. And this was all in the spring and summer of 2012. So, the libertarians, the party, and if you will, hardcore libertarians, don't accept him as a libertarian. But he does use their phrase a lot, and he has described himself as a conservatarian, which, as he said, is a combination conservative libertarian, things like that. And he I wouldn't say never, but very, very undersold or very hid, I think, his Christian religion or his Christian beliefs. He would have Saved by Jesus, a sinner saved by Jesus, in his Twitter profile. Right.
It's still there.
But other than that, he didn't really talk about religious issues or the religious politics of issues. He mainly focused on those libertarian issues. He certainly would do Second Amendment. He wrote a book with a hunting group, one of his early publications, and a lot of his early Turning Point USA publications were about gun rights. His first coming out book, Time for a Turning Point, was written with a co-author out of the Heartland Institute. I forget his name, but that's a big conservative, limited government freedom group out of, I think they're out of Illinois. And so for, I would say, the first 4 years of the existing 2012 to 2016, again, if you didn't know Turning Point, it was very small. It had a few hundred thousand dollars out in a budget. And they expanded to college campuses, and basically he is your college campus, provocateur, go on campus, make some video clips, invite people in to a big thing. I've been to two of them. They were both at the University of Georgia. He has, you know, toured in different campuses. The University of Georgia Turning Point USA chapter is pretty big. And they've invited him on to their campus twice. I've been to that. And as much as what you would think, it's a small Trump rally without Trump.
Right.
There's music. There's a Q&A. And that's really where he does his best work, is getting a question from a liberal or a lefty. And it's really just, you know, mocking them or turning the question around so the debate is lost, and anything along those lines. And that makes a clip. And he has, as you said, been very successful at using social media, particularly Twitter and now Instagram. I mean, early on, his Twitter account was him tweeting at conservative politicians, hey, I'm a young person starting a group. Can I get you on, you know, or can I have time with you?
Right.
And now it's completely switched. He is the platform that all the other people go to.
Oh, totally. I mean, yeah. Honestly, his Twitter's, in my view, pretty embarrassing. I mean, some of the stuff he tweets, I'm like, dude, have you thought about what you're saying? Like, I mean, he's one of these people who really toe the fine line of like conspiracy theory versus like, okay, maybe I disagree with him. Like he said things I'm like, dude, that's borderline conspiracy theory level here.
Right, yeah, I mean, he totally believes that Trump won the election. So that's certainly a conspiracy theory.
Yes, but back to
your question about how he became a culture warrior for God. So his religious biography, if you will, starts at Harvest Bible Chapel or Harvest Chapel in Chicagoland, in the Chicago suburbs. I think they had 7-8 campuses with James McDonald, of course, who was fired and, left that place.
James McDonald.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes,
it all right. Connects.
Yeah, totally. And what we learn about Kirk's religious leanings is the tidbits he leaves in these interviews that he does with people. And then you have to go look up different things. But he was a regular attender. I don't really call it a member, but he certainly was a part of Harvest Bible Chapel, Chapel, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. So much to the point that two big events happened. One, he gave a graduation speech, not a commencement, but a baccalaureate kind of deal. To their high school seniors in 2018, I want to say, where he repeated James McDonald's gospel mantra, two words, one word, I forget what it is. And then second, I believe it was on the 30th anniversary special of Harvest. They had a bunch of people come in and do video clips about what the church has been to them. And Luke McDonald, the son of James, did an interview with Charlie on a set, and I think they played it in church. I didn't actually see it, but it was on YouTube until they took all those down after James McDonald was fired. But basically in that video, Charlie says, I've been attending here. I've learned a lot from James. And he says kind of directly, while I'm a Christian, I don't really, use my religion in my politics. And he says that same thing to Dave Rubin, the lefty, righty, whatever you want to call him, commentator in 2018. So up to 2018 now.
Wow. So we're 2 years into Trump as well.
Yeah, okay. Right. And so 2016, Kirk spends the summer, election summer, with Don Jr. as his personal assistant. Just like, hey, can I follow you around? And he does for the entire campaign. And that's how they become best friends.
Okay.
And that's why Don Jr. shows up at all the campus events that they have before the pandemic. And so 2 years in, Trump is speaking at Turning Point USA summer events. I think he spoke it twice during his administration. Don Jr. speaks at all the events. And still, there is no religious, speaking from Kirk about connecting religion and politics. And so he comes out with the MAGA doctrine in late 2019, I think it is. And still there's very little religion in that book, which is like what he's trying to make Trump into some sort of like making sense person.
Right.
But there's no mention or little mention of religion. So even up to then, in early 2019, when he's writing the book, there's still no religious mention. And so there isn't one moment or one time where Kirk seems to make this turn. I want to nail it down to two things. One is his association with Liberty University.
Oh, yeah. Jerry Falwell Jr.
He started the Falkirk Center, which has been renamed.
Yes.
But also they gave him an honorary degree. That place, of course, is known for its evangelical Christian nationalism, right? So he met several people through that network. And one of those people was Rob McCoy, who was a megachurch pastor in California, who is the prototypical Christian nationalist pastor. He was on the city council with Thousand Oaks, elected government official and also pastor, which is not unheard of in many different circles. But he resigned that position, that city council position, because he does not agree with the mandates of COVID vaccine that he was being asked to enforce as a government official. And of course, would have, really hampered his ministry. His personal church followed a lot of them. And I think at some point gave communion one-on-one in the building. But there were many other churches in California and, of course, around the nation that just didn't follow any guidelines at all.
Oh, I know. I followed a lot of those guys. Yeah. It was crazy.
So at some point in 2019, Rob McCoy meets Charlie Kirk at an event. He didn't say where. This comes from Charlie Kirk's tour of churches he's done the last year. And they met and they started talking, and Rob McCoy challenges him. Hey, you're a Christian. I want to talk to you more about how the Bible talks about religion and politics.
Oh boy.
And, you know, and so over a series of conversations, Charlie Kirk is converted. And that's really the two influences that we have from Charlie Kirk's own mouth. Liberty University and Rob McCoy seem to have driven Charlie Kirk into this new stage of Christian nationalism.
Well, let me just say, it's evident that you really know your stuff on this. So I appreciate that, because in the world of social media, it's hard to like have a source that you can say, this person really, he's close to the center of all this, you know? So I appreciate you sharing that, because I have found, and I'm sure you've seen this too, that Christian nationalism has really exploded over the past 4 years, and even more so the past 2 years. Right. And I'm seeing more and more of these conservative media commentators like Charlie Kirk, Candace Owens is another one, Ben Shapiro, who I think what's happening is they're realizing who their base is. And they're like, okay, I got to start really playing to this base. Like, I know for a fact Candace Owens is speaking at at least two mega churches this summer out in California, and they're charging up to $200 a head, you know, for her. And she's speaking on like a Sunday morning. And I'm like, oh my God.
They're charging.
Yeah. And I am shocked. I'm like, okay. And Candace Owens is not very vocal, as far as I can tell yet, about her faith, but I suspect we're going to see the same turn. So let's move this conversation into this idea of Christian nationalism, okay? Because I am a layperson. I am not well-educated. You know, I have some college under my belt. But getting from someone who I think, you know, knows a little bit more, how do you define Christian nationalism? And what do you think has kind of caused this explosion, this like resurgence, if you will, of this very blatant Christian nationalism?
Well, there's been many scholars or experts that have written about this. I'm a rhetoric scholar, and I do rhetoric of religion, so I do pay attention to all of this. Several definitions are kind of floating out there. Andrew Whitehead and Sam Perry wrote a great book on that, and I don't know their exact definition, but basically it is a combination of some form of Christianity. I mean, you cannot do this with other religions, and a desire to see that religion rule in the United States, whether through the electoral process or not, because of the special place that religion holds for the United States. It is not merely the rhetoric of Ronald Reagan, city on a hill, that sort of thing. It goes beyond that to suggest, of course, that Christians should be in government, not just influencing government, but running government, and that Christian government should be run by a certain set of principles, not merely, good government or, you know, non-corrupt government. But, there's different extremes, but it is implementing the Old Testament, the Ten Commandments. It is implementing justice and mercy as well, but it is also implementing this culture part of it that, of course, does not appear in the Bible. And so it's mainly white. It's mainly evangelical. Yeah. It certainly has a Pentecostal bent to it, which is why you see a lot of those pastors hanging around Trump. It is a way in which they bring God's kingdom into existence.
Is this like
specifically in the United States?
Is this dominion theology you're starting to hint at here?
I think so.
Seven mountains? Is that kind of is that
Yeah, yeah. I mean, dominion, meaning the areas of the kingdom where Christians should rule. And there are seven mountaintops or seven mountains of cultural influence. And I can't name them all, but mainly it's the seven things you would think of, right? Government, media, politics, things like that. That is a combination of different things. I mean, if you saw the Michael Flynn news over the weekend and the coup thing, he gave that at a rally where the motto is for God and country. So it is a very specific, I want to say, version, and not real Christianity, but a specific version of Christianity where God and the United States are tied together.
Yeah.
But it is taking back America. Because there are constant notions of it being lost, right? Or it being moving away from certain things. Of course, socialism, communism, all those things play into as role well there. So it is returning God, returning, if you want to say, I mean, prayer in schools is a very small part of it.
Right,
but
right.
It takes that small part and goes the seven mountains of cultural influence. And that phrase Charlie Kirk mentions for the first time in February of 2020 at CPAC, which is the Conservative Political Action Committee. Yep. And he says that Donald Trump is the first president that understands those. So, you know, conservatives and Christian nationalists loved Ronald Reagan. They have replaced him with Donald Trump.
Yeah. Okay. That's helpful. And so I think, is it safe to say that Donald Trump and that election was one of the big catalysts of like maybe this either resurgence or more public expression of Christian nationalism? You know, like I know that like Bethel Church, for example, they've kind of hinted at Dominion theology. I know that already. But now it's like blatant. It's out in the open. A guy who supports it, quote unquote, is in the White House. Is that where we see this rise again of Christian nationalism just kind of exploding?
Well, certainly, yeah. I mean, Trump needed white evangelicals to come out for him, and they did in many ways in 16 and 2020. But in many ways, like Trump has given implicit permission to many different types of isms and racism and white nationalism, this also was given more permission to come about. But for it to be sustained now post-Trump, it needed a bit something else, right? So the big lie of the election, but also the Bible stories we know of not underdogs, but people who go through a time where they lose or a time when they're not successful or a time when they're shouted down. This is the mantra of Trump returning to office. And of course, it's bigger than Donald Trump. It is about the country. So it is a time of reckoning, a time of purification, a time of restoring. So these years of Biden, however long the administration is going to go, is the energy that is keeping Christian nationalism going. It started certainly with Donald Trump and him bringing those groups together that wouldn't normally come together. And that's why he was a successful candidate. But now it is much bigger than that. And so you see Charlie Kirk, right? Obviously a MAGA sycophant, a Trump loyalist, but he is building something bigger than just one person. Yeah.
No, for sure. I agree. This is a very interesting phenomenon for me because as someone who's very plugged into evangelical culture and grew up, you know, understanding it pretty well, this is one of the few times where I'm seeing groups that don't agree at all theologically really agree on this. Like I'm seeing fundamentalist groups agree with reform groups, with the more prosperity gospel groups, with the charismatic, like they're all aligned on this. They really are. And it honestly is, it's disheartening to see that it took, I would call it a heretical, you know, Christian nationalist movement to unite a church instead of like, you know, I don't know, loving your neighbor or something. Can you speak on, because something I'm seeing, and I saw that you wrote an article about this with Charlie, a kind of response, I'm noticing that the evangelical culture is so focused on making CRT, critical race theory, the newest boogeyman, that they either do not see the devil in their pews, you know, nationalism rising, or they want it to be bred and they support it. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think if you've grown up in evangelicalism, you know the power of purity, whether it's purity culture or keeping the pulpit pure or keeping our theology pure.
Totally.
So that has two aspects, the positive, let's make our theology crisp and understandable and all that and doing great work there. And it's also it's always paired with a negative, keeping certain things out. And of course the mantra of, you know, in the world, but not of it, but also the world impacts the church and the church impacts the world. And when you let the world in, it's the church that changes, all those things you've heard, right?
Totally. So,
but you have to make all those cliches specific at a time. And so I study rhetoric, and one of the key things in rhetoric is kairos, which is a moment in time, something that happens. It's not a chronological time. It's a moment in time that becomes very important. So you have to make that abstract thinking give it a face, right? And so we've seen many isms, cultural Marxism, socialism, communism, critical race theory, all of those become ways in which you focus the church's attention, and I put that in quotations, to keep itself from being invaded. It's kind of like election fraud and the election laws being passed. They can't point to any cases that made them pass these laws, but they're going to pass these laws, right?
Right.
And so I was going to say the thinking evangelicals, but as a whole, they're not known for that because Mark Knoll told us that. But people who don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater understand that you can learn from all these different things. I think there are many great African-American Black scholars, especially on Twitter, that I noticed that it says there are parts to CRT that are really helpful and some that are not, but all truth is God's truth. And so we should learn to understand it. And of course, there are other people who will see those three letters and think S-I-N and go away from it. It is difficult to really get people to talk about it. But at the same time, as you point out, there's all these groups coming together against one enemy. And if that isn't the definition of Christian nationalism, I don't know what is.
It's funny. I follow guys like Esau McCauley on Twitter, who I love. And I follow guys like James White on Twitter, who I don't like. So I get to see both of their, perspectives. And I love Esau's stuff. It's great. You said that, you teach rhetoric and, I'm trying to think of the best way to ask this question. So I grew up listening to these talk radio guys, right? Mm-hmm. I feel like they employ rhetoric really well because it's so convincing. Can you kind of like maybe dismantle like their rhetoric for me? Like, okay, because I'll put it this way. I'll be driving, listening to Sean Hannity. I'm thinking, dude, I know he's wrong. I can't explain why, but I just know what he's pushing is like hot air. What is it about their style of rhetoric that convinces so many people, even though there's so little substance underneath of it so often?
Well, the one rhetoric term that I think they all use, and I'd have to study to give you specific examples, but it's called the enthymeme. And it basically is a three-part argument.
Okay.
And they leave out one of the parts. It could be the conclusion. It could be a second part where you have to supply it yourself. But great radio hosts like Rush Limbaugh, right, provide just enough for the audience to then provide their own part, and it comes together in the end. It's believable because you're already primed to believe it, yes, of course, but you also have to be convinced daily to continue to listen. And so there are ways in which you provide a little bit of information to perhaps leave out or let the audience draw their own conclusion or provide their own part of the argument, and then you become one. You become together. You join together. You're unified now at the end of the hour or whatever, and you're called to take action. I mean, that's how rhetoric works. You have an introduction. You have a bring the audience into the argument kind of thing. You have reasons. You have evidence, maybe. And then you have this call to action, right? And so by the end, if you have done that well, if you have brought the audience along with you, which is a phrase I think all radio or TV people would do, you're golden. And that's why, of course, that many people have tried to replicate Rush Limbaugh, and many people have kind of done that. And Charlie Kirk is trying to do that. Yeah. But it is very good rhetoric because it involves the audience. It isn't just listening. You're not just being lectured to. It's like preaching in that regard. A good preacher is going to involve the audience even though they don't speak, right?
Right.
And so it is as if you're listening to him one-on-one.
Yes.
That is as if you can follow him and he is doing that. And that's what makes podcasts so good, because it has to be, you have to have someone to talk to, right?
Totally.
And so it's an enthymeme. And it basically, an enthymeme is leaving out one part of the argument, either supplying it by the audience's conclusion or something like that. And it's been there for thousands of years.
I've also found that a lot of those guys really imply things without saying it directly. Like they'll hint at things. Like I've never heard, before Rush passed away, I've never heard him say the election was stolen. But the way he would talk, he would kind of imply like, well, like it would plant this seed in your head, and you can never like go back in time and like say this is the moment where Rush Limbaugh said it. But he was so good at like giving you that power of suggestion, and I feel like that's another huge part of it. But my question is like, where does rhetoric, you know, where does rhetoric stop and like truth begin? Because I feel like one of the genius and also scariest things about the talk radio world, the conservative media world, is that technically, if they're ever pushed for it, like if Sean Hannity is ever subpoenaed by the government, he'll say, no, we're not a news show, we're an entertainment show. We're entertainment, but they don't position themselves like that to their audience at all. I mean, they just don't. I listen to them. You know, yeah. they make you feel like they're truth tellers, and this is not entertainment. This is life or death. You know, right. I mean, where do we draw the line with that kind of stuff?
Well, I mean, the question of rhetoric and truth is an age old question in our field, and Augustine certainly is a good example of that. But an example, I think, on Charlie Kirk is the best one. Great. So his very first thing that he wrote that got him a name was for Breitbart. And like I said, it was a criticism of an economics textbook that was based upon a Paul Krugman book. And so he was criticizing Paul Krugman. But the rhetorical move or the thing that Charlie Kirk does in that is imply that he has secret knowledge about how professors work or how colleges work or how liberal textbook writers work. And he's going to share that knowledge with his readers. Right. And so it's either, you know, some sort of insider information that they know what's going on, you know, or they know the truth. And so it works from a credibility standpoint. So how do you think, you know, high school kid from nowhere, Illinois, convinces people that he has secret knowledge? Well, he's a high school kid in a class with a textbook that his audience doesn't have. So it doesn't have to be a celebrity, or it doesn't have to be Michael Flynn on the stage saying there's going to be a coup and he's a general, you should believe him, right? It really depends upon the situation of the writer or the talker, right? So when Sean Hannity says it, you know that because he talks to Trump every day. Or when Tucker calls and says, this is what is really happening, he's connected. He knows all these things, right? You riding in your car in Alabama don't, and you're getting it from him. Right. So it is power of suggestion and power of implication, but it is also like I have the secret knowledge and I'm going to share it with you.
Well, you know,
so it is a truth, but it is a truth that they're selling. Right. Here's the truth that's happening.
Totally.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, I, as you're talking, of course, who do I think of? QAnon. I mean, that if that isn't like how QAnon exploded, this idea of an insider who knows things, has secret knowledge. And also, I mean, going back to the Rush and the Sean, they do that all the time. You know, like I have friends or this is happening or the drive-by media, right, as Rush always calls them. Here's what they don't want you to know.
And they're right. Here's what they don't want you to know. I'm going to tell you that. Right.
Right.
I mean, it's a move of authenticity because I'm going to be real with you, but it is also a move of knowledge. Yeah.
So really, these guys are like masters of rhetoric is what it sounds like. And they've used their power for bad. Maybe I guess we could say, you know, or something. I don't know. I guess it gets kind of murky, but at least on my vantage point, I'm thinking back to all these years of listening to these people and now seeing, you know, Charlie Kirk is like the new generation of that. He's like version 2.0 because Rush started this, right?
Yeah.
Talk radio was not a thing until Rush Limbaugh turned on that microphone. Right.
Yes.
So like that was version one. And that was pretty in Rush did a lot of things that I think were not appropriate. But people like Charlie or Candace, I mean, they're way more, I think,
right, because they have
intense.
To be, right?
Yes.
You can't just do Rush anymore. You have to do him 2.0 or 10 times, right? Because you have to hold the audience. They've heard the other things before.
Right.
Right. We can't just imply there was an election was stolen. We have to say there was a con. We have to say that there are fraudulent ballots. We have to say there's a van driving down the street with all these ballots. We have to show video of someone marking up ballots, right? And so you have to, I mean, it's egging on the audience. You have to keep them, and Trump is the master that is giving them pieces of information at a time and saying, I'm going to reveal. And it's kind of, I mean, that's the basis of Trump University, right? I'm going to teach you these things one by one, and you have to pay $500 for the next thing. And so it is a master of rhetoric, but it's also a master of manipulation. I mean, rhetoric and manipulation, the thin line there, I totally agree. I teach the ethics of rhetoric and how to do it ethically. I mean, it's really hard to do. I also wrote a book about the rhetoric of evil, so I understand how that works as well and how to use that in a better way. But yeah, it is stringing your audience along so that they will stay with you.
Well,
so they will not turn the channel.
Tell me if I'm wrong about this. Correct me if I'm wrong. But I feel like the I don't know, whatever the right word is, like a major ingredient in all this that that has made this really blow up is the fact that social media people have no memory, right? So like, for example, I remember during election night, I remember seeing the tweets, fake ballots found, ban this, you know, this is the big one. But in now we all know it's a bunch of malarkey, right? It's not true. But because our attention span in 2021 is that of a gnat, no one thinks, oh, wait, Charlie lied like 3 whole months ago or 5 months ago. And, you know, it's just out of sight, out of mind. And do you feel like that plays into this where people could just say things that maybe aren't true and they'll go, well, no matter what, it's going to blow over because it's Twitter. You know, like what is last week is like 10 years ago in Twitter days. Does that play a role in this as well?
You know, it certainly does. And it's really the central question of why I keep writing about Charlie Kirk. I mean, so you can fact check people and you can write the facts and PolitiFact does all these, right? But it does not matter. It will not change them and nor their followers, right? So the question becomes, why the lie? Why does Trump have to lie 10,000 times or whatever the number it was, right? And lie about the same thing again and again? Because the truth doesn't matter. It isn't. They don't care that they said the exact opposite several months ago or even yesterday, as in the case of Michael Flynn, right? It is the constant framing of it, a framing of the issue, a framing of the thing, so it reveals the thing that they want to say. Or to play it more simply, to always be on offense.
Right.
And so never to be on defense, right? So this constant, it is not a truth or not question. It is a, how can I frame this to be on offense? And so Charlie Kirk is really good at taking phrases and ideas and words that are often used by the left or used by his opponents and using it for his own gain. I mean, the COVID mask thing is a great example of that, right? We've lost our liberty. We lost our freedom. Masks don't help. I mean, he has all some claims without evidence about masks, but he has changed it into a question that he can play offense on, freedom and liberty and things like that. And then now we add the church thing. Pastors should open their churches because churches are essential, right? That comes from essential worker. And what does government say about what businesses can operate and when? I mean, he just used that for his own gain, and it is eaten up, right?
Eaten up. And that plays into this idea that Trump is going to disrupt the establishment, right? White evangelicals who overwhelmingly voted for Trump wanted someone to play offense for 4 years, and that's why I think nothing stuck to Trump. I mean, when in 2016, even before he got elected, when those comments came out of the Hollywood, you know, Access Hollywood tapes, right? Yeah. I thought to myself, oh, this is it. Like, thank
Everybody
God,
did, yes.
goodbye. Right. You know, like I grew up in Christianity. They know their purity culture, okay? And this is going to be a no-go. And then Jerry Falwell says, we need a commander in chief, not a pastor in chief. And people go, yeah, you're right. We really do, you know? And at that point, I'm losing my mind. But it was very clear from the beginning that this group of Christians who are huge segment of the American population wanted someone to play offense and would take the power grab at any cost, even their own theological beliefs.
Right. And let's not kid ourselves. Everyone, white evangelicals included, knew who Trump was when he ran.
Yeah.
He's a billionaire, married 3 times, host of things. Right. They knew what they were getting. Right. Yeah. It wasn't the Access Hollywood tape was not a surprise. That it was on tape is perhaps a surprise.
Right.
So there's not one moment we keep saying, you know, this should have ended him. This should have ended him. They knew what they were getting. And as you said, he was doing exactly what they wanted him to do. And you get that now with people who are trying to replicate him, like the woman from my state, Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Oh my God.
Right?
Holy smokes.
if Christian nationalism is a fight and playing offense and doing the Lord's work and not letting the gates of hell overcome us, which is, of course, us running over the gates of hell, right? Not stopping us.
Right.
It does not matter who the leader is.
Right.
Right. It doesn't. And so you can say anything you want, be any type of person you want, but you are God's chosen.
Totally.
I mean, the number of biblical characters that Trump has been compared to or said that he or that people have said he is just evidence of that. right? Charlie yeah. Kirk wrote an editorial implying that Trump was Jesus because everybody was abandoning him on Easter. Like, you can't get more Christian nationalist than that.
Right. And what happens in those circles? That goes under the radar. Like, no one calls it out. No one. Right. No one in Christendom is like, Charlie Kirk, this is heretical. This is unbiblical. There's only one Jesus. So suddenly, all of the arguments about how Jesus is king is suddenly like not that. He's not really, it doesn't really matter if he's king or not because, you know, Charlie said it, right? So like you said, the facts don't matter. It depends on who said it and how they said it and how they're, and like how they're pointing the gun. Like, who's the gun pointed at? Right? Because a good example of this is the immigration crisis. When this happened under Trump, I was critical of it for sure. A lot of people were critical of it. And what did conservatives and the machine do? Oh, this was Obama did this too, right? Blah, 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 blah. And now that it's still happening under Biden, I've been critical of it. And what are Republicans critical of? Joe Biden for the immigration crisis. Like, they don't care about what actually happened. They just care under whose watch it's happening and then how they have to spin it. That's all it comes down to.
And that is the political side of Christian nationalism. I mean, it is nationalistic. It is political. It is, if you will, they use the word patriotism. So it has that bit, right? But it also then has to have not the morality of the church, but the...
like the language.
Well, I mean, rhetoric and language, but also the salvation story, right? You have to bring the church along and it has to be saved and the United States has to be saved at the same time. And those two things have to come together. And so we may have to go through trials. We may have to go through a democratic president. We may have to go through socialism, right? But if we keep fighting, even if we lose, right? And that part is the part where Trump, you know, is a little bit off, right? Because he doesn't like to lose and he can't admit that he lost. Right. But there are plenty of white evangelicals who admit that he's no longer in the White House, right? You know, that he's not the president. They might not admit that he's not the real president, whatever, but they will admit that he's not there anymore.
Right.
So how do they deal with that? You know, how do they strain that? It is God's time of pruning, God's time of taking us in and making us.
Right.
I mean, there are a host of cognitive dissonance things you could say. And I'm not just talking abstract. I know people who say these things.
I interviewed someone who says these things.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like, because I had questions. I'm like, I got questions for you, man. You know, like, it's not adding up. It's just not. You know, the church language, the salvific part of it, it's just amazing to see it, like, in my view, just hijacked, like this gospel message just totally hijacked for a whole different purpose of trying to, I call it like the church persecution complex. Like, what? Here's what I get. There's actually a book by Richard Dror, I think, Live Not by Lies. I'm not sure if you ever heard of it. And, you know, I read it a couple of weeks ago, and like the guy is pretty much comparing like Soviet Russia, you know, to like the future of the U.S. if like we don't take America back for God, pretty much, right? And so like what I found is that like people are almost looking to have this happen to the U.S. Like they almost are at any day now, you know, the churches will be shut down. And then when we have churches shut down because of COVID, that's the smoking gun. And so it's like, you know, how does the mantra go? Like, if you're looking for it, you'll find it kind of thing. Right. That's what I feel is happening here all the time.
Yes, indeed. And we grew up in a culture, especially evangelical culture, where we had Jack Van Ippy every night. You could watch him and he would tell you what news event matched what verse in Revelation.
Totally.
And so we're primed to see the connections of, you know, the nation of Israel being formed or European Union be formed. And we're primed to see events happen in terms of, I don't want to use biblical worldview, but in terms of a biblical, you know, end of times.
Like eschatology. Yeah.
Right. And so you add just a little politics to that.
Yeah.
It doesn't take much, really, because again, you've had a series of people do this, right?
Yeah.
The thing I remember, I guess my first introduction to Christian nationalism, and I was a kid, I don't remember the exact date, but you know, Pat Robertson ran for president.
Yep.
And I saw a documentary about this, you know, years later, and they were interviewing someone who was on George H.W. Bush's staff. Of course, Bush was also ran for president and won the GOP nomination, blah, blah, blah. And Pat Robertson said, you know, I'm running a good versus evil campaign. And this was during the primary. And the staffer for Bush goes, so what does that make me? Right. Pat Robertson said that a person in his own party, the person who would become president, the person who was a Christian, Episcopalian, who had, you know, they'd known for years, right? He was the guy that was going to be evil in that scenario.
Right.
And I'm like, wow. You know, and that's one moment in a campaign that was failed from the beginning. He was never going to win, but he rallied the troops. And then there was Ralph Reed and Mormon Jordan.
Yes.
And then there was not a person in the plethora of people in 2016 that ran for the GOP nomination. There was not one person who could do all that except for Trump. And he was a celebrity. He had a TV show. He had millions. Yeah. He wasn't going to take money from people. He had everything going for him
right.
that was needed.
Yeah.
And he made nicknames for people, and it was over.
I know. I was there just losing my mind. So, you know, last just a couple questions here. Let's talk about the future. So where do you what do you see the future holding for, I would say, both Christianity as a whole in America, specifically evangelical Christianity? That's kind of our world right now. And then, you know, like, is nationalism going to keep growing, do you think? Like, what will it take to stop it? Can it be stopped? Like, what are your thoughts on going forward?
Well, I'll give you two point of views. One's a national one. I am not an expert in political science nor democracy, but just as a voter, I am deeply concerned about democracy. Because of the rise of Christian nationalism, because of the rise of what the Texas governor is doing, or the anti-voting laws and bills, and I know there could, right? If you want to, January 6th with an insurrection, it was an attempted coup. There's going to be some other people who are just as mad if and when another election, it could be 22 or 24, goes bad. So I'm deeply concerned at the national level about that.
Right.
At the local level, I constantly ask myself, you know, we're going to be in church again, in person, and we're going to be in groups. How do we talk about this in a place where we're supposed to talk about everything? You know, we shouldn't talk about politics in church. Well, we can, in a sense of, do you believe the big lie or not? And so how do we go in fellowship with people who believe that, either on some part of extreme or all the way to QAnon? How do you worship a God of truth with those people?
Yeah.
And I don't know how to answer that because I haven't been in an in-person service in over a year. But that is just as concerning, because we can pay attention to the national scene. We should. But the church, especially the white evangelical church, has a history of not talking about things. So the people who say just preach the gospel, we can talk about critical race theory, we can talk about justice and mercy and all those reparation things, but we also need to talk about perhaps more than those things, at least in the white evangelical churches, right? What you believe about January 6th and the election. And I don't know who starts that conversation, but it's like introducing yourself to a new friend. Do I want to become friends with this person? Okay, what happened on January 6th? Can you tell me?
Right.
Then if you don't, I don't know how we go from here.
Right, because it's a totally different, like, world than what actually happened, right? Like, not talking about, you know, like flavors of ice cream, or if you're a Republican or Democrat and why you believe that. We're talking about if you believe something that is totally not true and has been proven not true a million ways to Sunday. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. You know, like we have data that there was no big fraudulent election. Fraud happened like it does the same amount like it happens at every election, and not enough to sway any kind of decision. You know, I mean, that's just the bottom
line. Yeah. I mean, as a college kid, I covered the election in Florida in 2000. I know what that looks like. It's not this.
Right. Yeah. No, for sure. You know, I find myself very much in a similar boat where I'm thinking like, you know, the white evangelical church, well, I think honestly, the white evangelical church does get political. I've watched Patriot Sunday. I've watched pastors essentially say vote Republican from the pulpit on Sunday morning, give an hour and a half long sermon about it. There's actually a Patriot Church Network, I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, that's formed. There's about 10 churches right now, and there's more coming, you know? So they have no problem getting political. They just don't want to talk about like the reality of things, unfortunately. And if you do, you know, I think a lot of pastors who might want to speak out feel like, well, if I lose my congregation, I lose the tithe, I lose my finance, I lose my income, you know, and I understand that train of thought being concerned, but there's a bigger issue happening here that I think needs to be talked about. And honestly, I tell a lot of pastors whenever I talk to them about deconstruction or whatever else, I say, you might think you're discipling your church, but chances are Charlie Kirk, Candace Owens, Sean Hannity, they're discipling your church. Like, that's who they're studying under. It's not your once a week Sunday morning sermon. You can't hold a candle to the rhetoric and to the media dominance that these groups have on radio, on social media, you know, on podcasts. They dominate all those categories. They make you think that they don't, but they do. I mean, that's just
and they now combine it with a touch of Bible literacy, totally. You're in. So, you know, there are plenty of Sunday school classes and topics people could cover and books of the Bible. But I mean, how to fight disinformation in the church?
Right.
Why not have that?
Right. I'm with you. Well, listen, on that note, I'm going to let you go. I really appreciate all of your time. You seriously just a treasure trove of knowledge here. I mean, wow, so many good thoughts. Where can people find you? Where can they follow you? Where can they read the articles? Give us all your information. I'll put it in the show notes.
The article that you're mentioning was on Discover Flux. It's a new commentary website by Matthew Sheffield. My Twitter account is Matthew Bodie, at Matthew Bodie. Google me. I'm around. I've written a few things. I have a Medium website that is devoted to writing about Charlie Kirk. If you just Google me and Medium, you'll find it. It's there. And I'm on Twitter as well.
Great. Well, thanks for coming on. Keep up the great work. We need people like you more than ever. So do not stop whatever you're doing.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks. Bye.
Every year, one thing is always predictable. Postage costs go up. Stamps.com gives you crazy discounts of up to 89% off USPS and UPS services, so your business will barely notice the change. Stamps.com has been indispensable for over 1 million businesses just like yours. It's like your own personal post office. No lines, no traffic, no waiting. Sign up with promo code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com code PROGRAM.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.